Talk given Sunday, 9th September 1973. On a few occasions during past meetings, I have said that the one and only step one has to take in order to live the religious life in its depth is to step out into the void, the unknown. What is the reason for this? The culmination of the religious life, which means the full fruition of each and every one of us as a human being, is something which is unknown to us. If we predetermine that our fulfillment shall be such and such, or is such and such, or is going to be such and such, then we are held within the sphere of mortality, of ignorance, of desire. We are desire bound. Whatsoever is predetermined has desire for self completely associated with it. We can never be rid of it. Therefore, it is essential that what we commonly call the goal shall be no goal, because it is the unknown. A postulated goal is the already known, which belongs, or at any rate, is fast bound to the dead past. Now you see, this is something which is very difficult to appreciate. But that is the reason. One's fruition is unknown to us. Consider it this way, if you like. Each one of us is as if in the stage of the bud. Is it possible for the bud to know just precisely what it is going to be like as the flower? It doesn't. We can, in a generic way, say that yes, I am a rosebud, and therefore I shall become a rose, but I cannot predetermine this particular rose. That is why, in this generic way, we can say, yes, we are human beings in the making, and our flowering shall be the perfect human being. But that actual flowering can never be, must never be, prefigured by us. This is very important indeed. Therefore, it is perfectly true that if one wants to live the religious life in its reality, one steps out into the void, the unknown. Void in the sense of the unknown. Not in the sense of having no direction of growth. We are only vaguely aware, even though we may be strongly sensitive to the nature of that direction. That is what the intellect can know. It can have some sort of reasonably correct conception of the direction in which one is going to move. Not of one's volition, remember, but move with the movement of life itself. Life itself makes no mistakes. But we, if we are willful about it, which means predetermine this, that and the other, then we are always obstructing life. And hence there is no such thing as fulfillment or fruition. in the real sense. You know, the theists have put it in these terms, put your trust in God. This is one of its meanings. And the theists are unable to live up to it because they preconceive God to start with. God is such and such a fellow. Myself in apotheosis. And if he is not like that, well, I think he couldn't be the true God. Haven't every single religion done that? And fallen by the wayside in consequence? So now, this suggestion I have made, as I say, several times in past meetings during the last 2 years at least. How many of us have taken up that suggestion, have really meditated upon it, gone into the depth of it, understood it, and practiced it? And what is the result? I ask these questions, please realize quite clearly, not because I want you to do it, not at all. Nothing is laid down. You are totally free. And you have to be left in total freedom. Up till the present century, practically, ways were laid down. It was the accepted method. Here was somebody who was recognized as a teacher, a sure of the way, a holy one, a perfected one, and all the rest of it. And one put one's trust and faith in him and completely gave oneself to him and carried out his instructions in the letter and the spirit. Now, that was a way which fitted in with the actual human world situation in past centuries. Past centuries were characterized by authority, by hierarchy, by the relationship of teacher, disciple, employer, employee, the commander, the obedient, and so forth. So many of the religions have laid down commandments. Thou shalt not. Two religions have laid down no commandments, Buddhism and Hinduism. They are the outstanding exceptions. The moralities that are presented in Hinduism and Buddhism are advices. That is all. If your real concern is to live the holy life, then it will be better if you abstain from harming all creatures. Putting it in the positive form, the commandment, thou shalt not kill. Killing is the most dramatic expression, one of the most fearful expressions of harming other people, isn't it? Now, those religions laid down commandments. These religions proffered advices. If your concern is the holy life, the allowing of life in its totality to come to fruition through you, which means that your true destiny as a human being is fulfilled, then you will find it preferable to abstain from all harming. The same with stealing, the same with the indulgence of the senses and all the rest of it. See, there was this difference. So now past centuries, on the whole, have been marked by authority, by hierarchy, by the laid down disciplines, and so on. When the disciple, the son of the prophet, the bhikkhu, the chela, use whatever term you like, when he had come to that stage where he had come to the end of the conditioning process by the teacher, and the teacher saw that this one was ripe for realizing perfect liberation, then he imparted to him what were known as the great sayings. Today those great sayings are just bandied about by the public. Everybody just blurts them out, just as every pious fellow in a hurry says, "I believe in God the Father," etc., 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 quite quickly like that. And the dear old father cannot even hear because of the speed at which it is said. See? Now, these great sayings, you all know them. For instance, the Upanishadic saying, "That art thou. Tat tvam asi." The other saying, which of course is the bane of all theologians, "Aham Brahmasmi," I am Brahman, literally translated. "Aham Brahmasmi." Brahman, I think everyone knows the meaning of the word Brahman, the Hindu word which stands for the absolute, supreme reality, whatever it is, you see, and so forth. "Aham Brahmasmi." But what is not understood, and as far as the ordinary tomes expounding the Upanishads go, it has never been explained in any of them. What does the word "ahang" mean in that context? "Ahang" ordinarily is I. When I am talking to you, well, this man is talking to that person. That's all it means, I, you see. Or "I went to Victoria Station." Well, then this fellow went to Victoria Station. But in that transcendental context, what does the word "ahang" mean? The meaning of "ahang," I, in that transcendental context, is put in its, I believe, its most perfect form in the Tejobindu Upanishad, when the words are put into the mouth of Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity. Shiva answers his grandson, Kumara the Kartikeya, as he is known. He's a prince, apparently, Kumara. See? The words are, "I am the I which has given up or become freed from I." Just really feel that sensitively. "I am the I that has given up I." Obviously, it does not merely mean a kind of a self-abnegation, which is the giving up of the organism which goes by one's name. Does not mean self-sacrifice or any such thing in that little sense, that personal context. Because if you go deeply into the meaning of the word "I," you will soon discover that the only reality of the "I" is not that which stops at the skin, the skin bagful, which is called "I," you see, doesn't stop there. If you really go into it sensitively, you will find that the word, that the only true meaning of the word "I" is the totality, the entire universe, all that there is. the totality which can never become more, which can never become less. Otherwise it denies the meaning of the word totality. Totality is everlastingly totality. What we call birth, death, increase, decrease, everything is one totality, neither being born nor dying, increasing or decreasing, etc. And the word I is synonymous with this. As I have put it in other terms, supposing Brahman were to speak the English language and say I, then that I is the meaning of the word Atma and the one and only real meaning of the word I. I. There is no other. No otherness. No division in the unity of the whole is present. So now, I am Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi. So the word I, aham, in that context implies that which is the unabandonable. It implies the total reality. And then it is a simple fact to state, I am Brahman. This must be clearly understood. You and I can understand it because we have the intellect to understand such things. But you grasp it intellectually. But having grasped it intellectually, if it is to mean anything and not bring harm to you, then you must become fully sensitive to the reality of it. Because if I were to grasp it purely intellectually and not let this inner sensitivity grow and be at one with what the intellect has accepted, pride, conceit, domination, cruelty, all these things will come up. This is the trouble with the intellect. You know how the Tibetans, for example, associate intellect with the wrathful deities. And the heart with the beneficent deities, the benign ones. But heart and intellect are two terms for the one reality of mind. These are the two sides of the coin. See? All right. So these great sayings were imparted by the teacher to the disciple. And then the disciple proceeded to become the truth, which was suggested through the medium of the words. This is one of the most important aspects of religious discipline, religious training. Unlike any other kind of discipline and training in the world of affairs, in science, in philosophy as we learn it nowadays at school or anything like that, unlike any of those disciplines, which is an acquisition of learning, of knowledge, of a know-how and a skill by the brain, by the intellect, and if it involves technical skill, also practical skill with your hands or body or whatever it is, unlike all that, religious discipline is fundamentally not an acquisition. In fact, it is a freeing yourself from all acquisition whatsoever, but you become in consciousness that which the words stand for. Now, this is the sort of thing that is missed out. Grievously missed out by rather a large number of gurus and the modern maharishis and whatnots. It's missed out. the proof of its being missed out? Don't they try to inveigle you into living the holy life? Into the repetition of your mantra, your magic spell, which will bring you fulfillment, bring you happiness, bring you success, bring you freedom and consolation and all the rest of it? Do remember, whatsoever is self-oriented is irreligious. Religion means the complete reversal. The reversal perhaps is not really the best word. The complete inside outing of all selfness. A complete inside outing. No theistic, nonsensical, everlasting fellowship as an individual entity with another divine entity called God. That's childishness. That's a carrot held before the donkey brain. No. The complete inside outing of all self-orientation. Now, if one starts with that, what has one started with? The unknown, the void, the emptiness, which is the reality of the plenitude, because in that is the total fullness. If this little block, which is the I, turns inside out, if this I then has given up the I, you see, then what is there in fact? The totality. The absolute is there. The thing which contains everything, throws out nothing, which does not expend, incontinently use its life energy to draw the world unto itself, but allows the totality to flow through its own emptied self as the transparent, enlightening, all-compassionate focus. This is a very different thing. This is religion. But that is your fullness. Your coming to fruition, your real flowering. There is no other. Then there is no problem of acceptance, rejection, of good, evil, and so on. The duals get transcended. And do remember, all this happens in your innermost awareness, in your innermost consciousness, which means that peculiar sensitivity which characterizes the organism known as the living human being. And only the living human being has it. A lion, a tiger, a mosquito, an ant, a tree, a stone doesn't have it in the manner in which you and I have it. This is how we are made. And you can easily see something, you can get a glimpse of the purpose of human existence out of that. That it is out of the human kingdom that this is to emerge, this marvel. And it is transcendence itself which comes to full self-consciousness, to individuality in the true and the complete sense through each and every one of us. And because transcendence comes to fruition through each and every one of us, the great Upanishadic teachers, the Buddha, they all use the term aham, I. This is where the theists have a beautifully poetic expression. It was the voice of God speaking through them. Now you see, that voice of God in itself is completely authoritative without imposing authority anywhere at any time. But the disciples had never understood that. The great religious organizations which sprang up, which we know as the great religions of the world, have accepted the lesser aspect of it, namely the prevailing method by which the pupil, the disciple, reached that stage of realization and had this command obedience. You just obey the teacher. Yeah. Today the world is different. Completely different. And perhaps it's not untrue to say that this country has played one of the leading parts, made the major contribution to that difference. I am referring to the sense of individuality which people have, and the respect to the individual. Unfortunately, after the last war, that has shown considerable signs of deterioration. There is little respect for personality, for individuals as individuals in their own right. It is this country which has made a tremendous contribution towards that state. We have class. We have had class, but we have not had caste. You see, that is to say, bound hereditarily to the fact of birth. If my father was a dustman I be, and my son shall be a dustman too. The only escape from that was, the only release, I should say, not escape, the only release from that was, in India, if anyone wished to tread the religious path, he was free to go. He could become a Brahman thereby. So forth. We have had class. And so forth. But we have developed a far greater degree of personal freedom than practically any other nation. But that freedom, unfortunately, has become degenerated to license. Instead of realizing that freedom entails duties, responsibilities, and so forth, freedom is degrading to the hopelessly wrong and evil meaning attached to that word freedom. Namely, I do what I like. And I like is about the greatest curse which lies upon humanity today. Now, that's another matter. Let's come back to this. I think we can see, to a reasonable extent at least, what is the meaning then of stepping into the void, into the unknown. That old day of authority and hierarchy is over. And as I've just said, we have contributed very strongly to it. Today, each person has to, of his own will and accord, his own perceptions, see the hint, understand it, consider it within himself, and then let that consideration within himself be his guide to practical expression, not merely in physical action, but in thought, in behavior, in everything. That is why I insist always upon saying, you must not regard me as a teacher or any such thing in that old sense. Because that means bondage. and I refuse to accept any bondage from the most devoted follower. You see, I love his devotion, but out with his following. You stand on your feet and walk. I'm not carrying anybody. Besides, I'm far too old now to carry anybody. We'll both fall down with a big bump. See? All right. So, it behoves the listener to be awake. See the hint. And there are so many hints being thrown out always in these meetings. And see which one applies to you. If I were to lay down, you do this, you do that, you do the other, it may be quite the wrong thing for you. But if there is a whole lot of hints floating about, suggestions only, whatever you feel, to whichever one of them, you feel a response coming from within you, and you say, ah yes, that's it, I'll try it out. Now, the situation is perfectly right. Neither are you bound to me, nor am I bound to you. And in that state of real freedom, one can grow. Does any gardener make a funny brick structure after he has planted a seed, predetermining how the tree that will emerge from that seed shall grow? Unfortunate tree. It'll be a caricature of a tree, won't it? It'll be, to say the least, a somewhat sad, unhappy tree. Now that is what happens to us human beings. Look very carefully. All the conditioning that has laid upon us, all for our own good, of course. And it's rather a strange thing that people who are not wholly good themselves, including our dear parents and friends and teachers and all the rest of it, you see, shall know what is good for the other person. Miracle of miracles. We are so not sensible, hard-headed, practical people. It's the trouble of being the hard-headed, practical person. The practicality is too crushed within that hard head. All right. Now, to be serious, therefore, this stepping out into the void, into the unknown, you accept, you understand your own self-responsibility. And you understand that the way of growth is the free way for you yourself. Not senseless experimentation launching out into action, but deep consideration. Let me remind you of the real meaning of the word consideration, or to consider, the verb to consider. Con, together with. And the sideration comes from sidus sideris, a star. What is a star? A self-shining light. You are the star into which you look. The self-shining within you. Did not the Buddha himself teach? Look within, thou art Buddha. Enlightenment is within you. Look into that light within you. That is what consideration means. And for consideration, it is essential to be quiet. Just to observe, to be quiet. Watch it, look at it. Don't talk back at it. Let it keep talking to you. And if you allow that, that light within, as it talks to you, will cleanse away all the obstacles. It will transform all the solid, opaque, obstructing stuff in our psyche into pure energy, of human life and action. And you will see and know for yourself. This is the stepping into the void, the unknown. Because this is something which you don't know yet. Don't know in terms of actual living process. This also is the meaning of meditation. Sitting down and starting off a process. You can take, for example, that remarkably good work by Dr. Kanza, Buddhist Meditation. Or you can take, if you like, if your heart lies that way, St. Ignatius of Loyola and what he suggests as the whole procedure of meditation, or take the hints of any of the great Christian mystics or the Sufis, or you can take the Judaic method. You can study Abraham Abu Lafia and Isaac Luria and various others who have produced marvelous systems and all the rest of it. They exist all over the world, these systems. But if you take the systems as such, you will see them with the mind that you already have, which is the unenlightened mind, and you will constrict the system into your own unenlightened condition. Well, what are you following? I, the blind man, am following my blindness. You see, this is the trouble. This is the sad part of the story. People never see these things. And so, the very fact that I go and grab at this system and the other is simply proves my self-orientedness. I want some relief somewhere. I want some pleasure somewhere. This is what underlies it. Why do I take to a religious system which I am told will purify me, open up my faculties, bring me enlightenment? Because that will be the supreme pleasure, the supreme happiness, as I call it. Let me have no illusions about it. I am pleasure-driven. Each one of us can look into our own selves and say, well, why do I turn to religion? What makes me go for religion? What's driving me to it? I will find, if I look with unblinkered eyes, that my own egoism, my own vanity, the retreat and the flight from my own frustrations and fears and discords and goodness knows what not, all these are the causes which drive me to religion as the refuge where I shall find what? What I like. Supposing nirvana, or the kingdom of heaven, happens to be that you are going to be crushed between two beds of nails, one on top of each other, and you are in between. That is nirvana. Now, you are going to strive for nirvana? No, you shout in indignation, I wouldn't be such a silly fool. But you know, the fact is, unfortunately, I am being that kind of fool all along the line. I just gave it in an absurdly horrible, dramatic form, two beds of nails crushing you, and you're in between. But look, this is what we do. If you and I cannot each have real compassion for oneself, how shall we begin to be compassionate to the dog next to us, or our neighbor, or whoever it is? And what does this compassion imply? Intelligence. Can any fool be compassionate? Only the wise one can. Can anyone be wise? Only the compassionate one. You see, within you is the kingdom of heaven. Transcendence is embodied there in each and every one of us. We don't need to seek it. All we need to do is to wake up to that fact by the removal of the obstructions in the way. And the obstructions are what the Buddha called the defilements of the mind. Our behavior. The Buddha talks about all this. All the great teachers did teach about all this. There's very scanty record in the New Testament about what Jesus taught about these matters. Unfortunately, that is the case. But the disciplines really are the same. The defilements of the mind. Our behavior in ordinary life. Our morality. All these things matter. Isn't it significant that in all the discourses of the Buddha, you find that when somebody comes to see him, whoever it is, they exchange the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. Very much like the so-called fuddy-duddy Victorians did. They exchanged the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. We, of course, now have become so honest that we throw aside politeness and courtesy. We call it hypocrisy. But what sort of hypocrisy do we practice today instead? The violent rebels, the world over, are always destroying. They create nothing. What does come out of them, often, is an excessive procreativeness. And then they throw the burden upon the state for the consequences of their misdemeanors. Let's have no illusions about it. If we see the fact, but see it without condemnation, without hate going out from oneself. Time and again, if you study your Vinaya Pitaka, that is the books of the Buddhist discipline for the monks, when misdemeanors take place, the Buddha talks in no uncertain terms about what has happened. You know how Jesus says, "You ye vipers and hypocrites." He tells them openly, "You're an awful lot of scoundrels and skunks," to use modern slang. He tells them quite openly, "That's what you are." And the Buddha tells his disciples also terrible things like that. Jesus says, it is better that if an eye offend thee, pluck it out. It is better for that one member shall perish, but that thy whole body be not cast into hell. Come in. So, one sees and observes the fact, whatsoever it be, but without hate. Seeing it without any reaction from me, the limited personality, means that I see with the eye of truth, which is also the eye of compassion, and which is also the heart of understanding. But surely all this is the stepping into the void, the unknown. Do you and I actually practice it? Are we mindful enough? Do we remain mindful? Or does the whole organism just deafen us with the noise of its clamor? I want this, I like that, etc., 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 all the time. desires, passions, appetites, whims, fancies. Of course a desire arises, of course a passion arises. Well, observe it. Such and such are the stimuli, this is how it works, and so forth and so forth. And in observing it truly and compassionately and wisely, it will get purified. And then the final product will be something which is purely human and not subhuman, and certainly not bestial. It's only man who can be bestial. All the animals are good animals. Not because they are superior to us, they are not. But simply because they are not gifted with the power of choice that we have. They can't turn inwards, look back into the storehouse of memory. They can't use their intellects to plan out pleasure, fulfillment. They can't do that. And therefore, they are just unavoidably good animals. They live according to the law of their being, naturally. We, in us, the great discord is between the body and the mind. The body is concerned and has to be concerned with self-preservation. Therefore, the body will draw out of the world to us food, drink, and the necessary activities which enable us to earn our living and all the rest of it. All right? That is the body. The body, having done that, the business of the mind is not this sort of action, but the going out in response to the totality. And in this comes the awakening in consciousness to the one total reality, to transcendence itself. So now you see, all this disciplinary process lies within us ourselves. That is, I've tried to explain something of the meaning of that statement I have made several times, that the one and only step required in living the religious life is to step out into the void, into the unknown. Because this freedom from bondage to selfness, this drawing the whole world just unto ourselves and not responding again in toto, completely back to the world, this is the thing which keeps us less than human. And religion, although perhaps etymologically one cannot claim that this is the real meaning, religion to me really has the same meaning as yoga. Yoga is a restoration of the individual person who has become cut off, separated from full awareness of the totality, back into the totality. The restoration of the part to the whole in full consciousness. Supposing the body itself is regarded as the whole, the totality. This body is made up of something like 15 billion cells. Each one of us human beings is like one of those cells in the body of the one total reality. Now you know, if a particular cell becomes diseased, it hurts the totality. The whole body feels unhappy about it, doesn't it? Pain, and so forth. But if it is restored to wholeness, what happens to that cell? that cell, the healed cell, is now in perfect harmony with the totality. Yoga does precisely this. Religion does precisely this. It restores me, the cell, into complete harmony with the totality. Now, you can take whatever you wish to take, whatever you can take out of our meeting today. Consider it carefully. Not just a mere intellectual analysis, but just look. No agreement or disagreement. Our petty little agreements and disagreements do not alter the truth of the universe. That truth is overwhelmingly great. But consider it. In that consideration, in quietness, the burden of sorrow will fall off. You will experience heart's ease. If there are tears, there'll be tears of joy, not of distress. They will not be the result of an unresolved conflict, a painful struggle within oneself, but of understanding. And if I may say one thing, I am concerned with your happiness in that sense, because it is that happiness which means goodness. The person who is happy in that sense is the person who is really naturally good. He doesn't know that he is good. This is the charm and the beauty of it. See what the Buddha said? The religious life is lovely in the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely at its ending. And it is this which matters. And if you're not happy in this sense, you can carry out any jolly old discipline you like, and you'll only be a nuisance to yourself and to your society. Make no mistake about it. But be happy this way, understanding the real meaning of happiness. And understanding that happiness is not something outside which you have to achieve and get. It constitutes you. Peace and quiet constitute you. The whole psyche is rooted in this transcendent reality of the totality of mind, which is happiness, beauty, love, wisdom, truth, goodness, use what word you like. Just let that come to fruition. There are just one or two little points associated with this which may be useful. The systems which we have of religious discipline, the scriptures themselves, are truly useful and valuable to us only after we have gone beyond the need for them. This is very true. Look, let us take an analogy from our human life, which is, on the whole, a fairly good analogy. If I am a musician, I have a gift, let us say, to compose music. When I start, let us assume that I also play some instrument or other with some reasonable skill. Or perhaps I can conduct an orchestra in a small way. When I study the scores and use them as my models, the great composers use them as models to write music myself, I only produce copies of the great ones. This activity is merely repetitive, procreative. Procreation is a repetitive process, isn't it? Out of procreation, only the same sort of creature comes out. A little squealing brat, as some might like to call it. But true creation is of a very different nature, very different order. Now, the analogy holds in a small way, not in a big way, not in the transcendent way, but in a small way it does hold. When I, the musician, through this practice, through this way, have really grown inside myself, and my creative musicianship has really come to flower, then the works I produce are something quite different from my little procreative productions as a musician. Now, having realized maturity and true creativeness where music is concerned, now when I look at the scores of the great composers, they have a totally different marvel and meaning to me. In an even smaller way, a violinist, a pianist, singer, whoever it is, learns the works, gives a brilliant performance, and so forth. The years pass by. He matures and matures within himself. If he's a real musician, he still studies his original scores of the great composers very, very carefully. He sees profounder beauties in them which he never saw before. And the maturing within himself comes out in his performance. You see? Having reached the top of the concert platform, and when he's beyond the need of knowing the scores which were written down by the great composers, now he sees greater beauty in them, greater marvel, and he knows how to bring them out. Now, you step out into the void, into the unknown. You won't hurt, you won't fall. There's nowhere to fall to in the void, in the unknown. You're like a bird in the uncharted abyss, your domain. You won't fall, you won't hurt yourself. Step out into that unknown and realize the truth which is possible for you to realize in your unique way. Then go to the scriptures. Then look at all the laid down techniques of the past. And you'll see, my God, but this is what they meant. This is what they were working for. I never knew it before. And what's more, I could never know it before because I went for them mechanically. They are living processes, and the life process is unique and individual to you. You can't take another's life process and live by it. If you're hungry, I can't eat on your behalf. Quite impossible. It's like that. So you see, it's within you. And then you'll know creativeness. someday we'll perhaps talk about this creative pulse, which is at the very root and heart of all existence. But for today, let us say, not sufficient is the evil thereof, but sufficient is the food thereof. Thank you.